Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books in Popular Culture, and today I'm here with John Gennari, the author of Flavor and Soul, Italian America and its African American Edge. Hi, John. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Rebecca. Thank you for having me.
So I'm hoping you can start out by just sharing a little bit about how you got interested in the topic that you wrote about, how you sort of got interested in writing this book.
So this book really comes out of an interest I developed in, I think, the late 80s, early 90s. I was still in graduate school doing a PhD in American studies, or as we call it at the University of Pennsylvania at the time, American civilization. And most of my, kind of specialized work was focused on African-American history and culture, leading to a dissertation on jazz criticism in particular. But I was sort of training myself to be a kind of cultural historian of the African-American arts in relationship to social and political history. And I came from an Italian-American background, grew up in a small town in western Massachusetts, Lenox, Massachusetts. And through my mother's family in New Jersey, Bergen County, New Jersey, just over the Hudson River from New York City, it was visiting my Italian relatives in that part of New Jersey and getting a bit familiar with New York City, and then later living in New York after I graduated college and before I started graduate school. And living in neighborhoods that were multiracial, but interestingly, both Italian and Black, or they were, kind of borderland territories where Italian Americans and African Americans had, lived cheek by jowl for generations. And as much as anything, I probably can date the interest in writing about this to the two Spike Lee movies. Do the Right Thing from 1989 and Jungle Fever from 1991, both of which I talk about in a chapter in the book about Spike Lee's, sort of Italian-American period, if you will. But I think there was a moment in the early to mid-90s when American popular culture had a lot of Black-Italian crossover. This was a time when hip hop and rap music was moving into what became known as gangster rap. And if you look at the way Snoop Dogg and other, Black rappers were positioning themselves, image wise and the kind of cultural backdrop that they were shaping for themselves, a lot of it had to do with Italian American culture, mob culture, gangsters, but more generally, this, as I later, I think, tried to conceptualize it, a kind of relationship to Italian American masculinity and Italian American ethnic outsider masculinity in particular. And Sinatra, you know, against all, you know, sort of sense aesthetically, at least to my ear, because his music is so different from hip hop and rap, he was taken up in this period by people, black major black figures in the hip hop world, as a kind of OG, an original gangster. And there was a really exceptional piece of writing in Vibe magazine in 1995 by a writer named Bones Malone, who I had been reading in Vibe, and had really been very interested in the kind of vernacular hip hop Brooklyn kind of voice that he was developing for talking about music and black culture. And he wrote a piece about Sinatra that was a to Sinatra as a figure who meant a lot to black men like himself, as kind of a ethnic outsider who becomes eventually the ultimate kind of insider and a kind of, you know, chairman of the board figure who, you know, ends up owning a record company at a racetrack, you know, all the stuff that we associate with Sinatra in his prime. And so that combination of, you know, a kind of suspect, even criminalized masculinity combined with a narrative of assimilation, at least into wealth and a certain kind of power and certainly a certain kind of celebrity, really, you know, resonated among, you know, a certain cadre of people in the hip hop world. And then things just start popping up all over the place. There was this television show, NBC police drama called Homicide, Life on the Street, set in Baltimore, that ran in the 90s, maybe into the early aughts. And it had characters who were black and Italian. And it was also very much centered on black and Italian kind of neighborhood culture in Baltimore at the time. And what, you know, once you start noticing these things, then you start seeing them all over the place. And then you start thinking back historically and, you know, so what was Sinatra's relationship with the black musicians of his own time and his own ilk? And it turns out he had a very tight relationship with people in the jazz world, people in the sports world, people in the civil rights world. And so Sinatra really had a kind of insider status among black elites, you know, sort of across the sports and entertainment and political realms. And Sinatra becomes the book for that reason. Food is really central to the book. And I began to really think about the ways that Italian food stuff and food ways and the importance of food spaces figure in both cultures very powerfully. And then sports. And I have a chapter in the book on college basketball. And it just struck me all of a sudden in that period I'm talking about that so many of the most prominent college kind of celebrity coaches of the time were Italian American. This is a time when Italian American players of any note were kind of few and far between. You saw it more in the women's game than the men's game. And so I get interested in the way that, you know, people like John Calipari and Rick Pitino and Raleigh Massimino and others, particularly in the Big East, which was a fairly new basketball conference at the time and a really powerful one in shaping the kind of cultural imagination of basketball in that period. And it had a very Northeastern urban sensibility to it. And so I began to think of that as a kind of black Italian cultural space as well. But it took me a long time to shape all this into a book. I was doing lots of other work in the meantime. And by the time I got time to come back around to it and put it into the form that it appears in this book, a whole field had developed around me that was interested in, you know, not just these kinds of inter-ethnic contact zones, but also the whole question of the racial identity, the raciality, if you will, of Italians and Italian Americans, and how race works within Italian culture itself.
Right. And so you talk about, you said that you, you know, you've divided this into sort of different chapters that get at different things. And you start with Frank Sinatra. And you talked a little bit in that introduction about how you looked at Frank Sinatra with his relationship with African Americans. And you also talk about it with his relationship with Italian Americans and what he represented. And so I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about Frank Sinatra and why he is so important to both to Italian Americans as well, and to that sort of crossover or that interdisciplinarity that you're, or that inter-ethnicity that you're talking about.
So, I mean, Frank Sinatra in many ways is the dominant kind of symbol of Italian America, Italian American culture, Italian American success. I mean, there's a kind of a romanticization or a kind of mythification of his childhood to make it look like a, you know, kind of up from the streets, bootstrappy kind of story. And in fact, he was, you know, kind of fairly well off, at least comparatively speaking, compared to other second generation Italian Americans. His parents were both immigrants in a place like Hoboken. But the narrative of his ascent to the, you know, very top of the world of entertainment, and then, you know, becoming somebody who's who's a kingmaker, you know, in relation to the Kennedy presidency. And I mean, he's just a kind of larger than life figure, and a source of great pride for Italian Americans because of that, but also because of the fact that he didn't change his name as you know, mediators and managers wanted him to do, as many, you know, kind of ethnic figures from Italian and Jewish backgrounds did in that period. He maintained. I mean, it's interesting. When you hear him sing, he has a kind of elocution, is very studied, and he worked on very assiduously to, you know, to sound like somebody who had mastered and had always spoke the English language, and translated into, you know, that kind of bel canto purity of tone. But when you heard him off stage, you know, the kind of saloon Sinatra, it was a very heavily accented, you know, kind of vernacular Italian. And the people he hung in that language, you know, was one with the milieu in which he kept himself. So, you know, even as he was traversing cultural and class barriers, he always maintained a sense of connection to his roots, or at least it was thought to be that way. He, you know, he had no interest in going back to Hoboken, and you know, he spent, you know, most of his life in California as a, you know, as a wealthy, you know, celebrity. But there was a you know, the kind of interpretive community, if you will, or the ethnic, the Italian American, you know, kind of popular discourse about Italia, about Sinatra, it enabled a kind of ethnic pride, in a sense that this was somebody who represented all of us. And so there was that. I go on in that chapter a bit about my own family history and relationship to Sinatra. My mother growing up, my mother's family being just a couple towns over in northern New Jersey. One of my uncles, a construction worker building one of Dolly Sinatra's retirement homes. I mean, my family was, I mean, they're thousands, tens of thousands of families now who claim to have been close to, you know, to the Sinatras back in the day. And my family had that kind of, you know, made that kind of claim, but we were, you know, we were no more, you know, kind of connected to them than, than anybody else. That sense of, I mean, here was somebody who was, I mean, at a time when, you know, there was still a lot of discrimination against Italians. There was still a kind of criminalization of Italians. There was nothing like the prominence of Italian Americans in education and the arts and business and politics as there later came to be. So Sinatra was sort of a stand-in for all of that. And that was true in my family, although he was a complicated kind of vexed figure in my family, because at least with my parents, Sinatra's politics, his move from being a very stout, you know, kind of Roosevelt New Deal liberal to later flirting with conservatism and becoming associated with Reagan and even Nixon, that rubbed my very liberal, politically very liberal parents the wrong way. And there was always talk about, you know, Sinatra was, he was a very messy man. He led a very messy life. He, you know, got divorced and he carried on with, women, and he got in fights, and he, he could be really a nasty person. And there was, there was always, you know, a kind of, among the men, there tended to be a kind of rationalization and defense of that. The women were more critical of that, at the same time that they also, you know, revered him as an artist. And I haven't said a word yet about really what a, you know, extraordinary performer he was, and just the way in which he shaped American popular music as a singer. Who brought to, mid-20th century, the singing of that great canon of songs that were written, you know, from the 20s on. He brought a particular kind of, to singing that made the songs his songs. You know, we think of these songs as Sinatra songs, even though every singer, every popular singer of the time sang those songs. I mean, he just seemed to have a unique ability to personalize what he was singing, and that kind of charisma was very affecting in Italian American communities that I argue in the book have always had a real appreciation for, if not the formal arts, although there's that as well, then of style, stylization. La bella figura, the concept of the beautiful figure, and performativity. I mean, we're people who, we're always acting out scenes. We're almost always dramatizing things. We're emotional. We, you know, wear our emotions on our sleeves, all of that. And the messiness of Sinatra's life and the nobility of his life together seem to, resonate very strongly within my family and other Italian American families.
Yeah. And so also in this chapter, and you mentioned this earlier, but I'm not sure if there's anything you want to add to it. You do talk about how this sort of nostalgia and this romanticism of Sinatra becomes really important to gangster rap in the early 1990s. And I'm not sure if there's anything else you want to add to that or expound on with that relationship and why you really see that relationship happening and occurring.
Well, again, you know, I think it has to do with this this sense of, you know, kind of grandiose masculinity, you know, the big man, the way in which Sinatra made it all about himself, in good ways and bad, but he was a kind of padrone or a kind of patriarchal figure in in a very patriarchal culture. And I think the rap and hip hop world has a kind of nostalgia for that and reproduces some of the best and worst features of that. So there's that. There's also, I argue in this, the chapter quite, you know, kind of paradoxically ends up being about mothers and femininity and how I think Sinatra's mother, Dolly Sinatra, plays a kind of outsized role in the cultural memory of Sinatra in a way that maps onto a larger phenomenon of the, you know, kind of romanticization of the Italian American mother as, you know, kind of everybody's mother. And this to me is perfectly consonant with the history of the Black Mammy and, you know, the idea of the Black woman as a, you know, kind of outsized figure, as well as on the other side, the, you know, kind of social science discourse about the problems of matriarchy leading to dysfunction within the Black families. So similar arguments were made about Italian American families in the 1950s and early 60s. So the mother is a kind of, you know, kind of vexed figure, but cultures, both black culture and Italian culture being about, if you're going to be a strong man, you need strong women and you need a strong mother. And sometimes you're not as strong as your mother. And the difference, I think, between Sinatra and at least the part of the gangster rap culture that I don't particularly care for, although there are parts of it that I do like very much, that, you know, whereas Sinatra, I think, was in his art able to achieve a really interesting balance of the masculine and the feminine and, you know, this kind of tough and tender persona and this emotional vulnerability. I mean, something happened, not just within rap culture, but I think within American culture more broadly in recent years, something about masculinity that, you know, seeks to at all costs, you know, distance itself from any hint of emotional vulnerability. So there, in other words, there are some affinities and continuities between Sinatra and the rappers, but I think some important differences as well.
So you move from Sinatra and his relationship to Italian Americans and also his influence on rap and hip hop to food. And so in your second chapter, you talk a great deal about that relationship to Italian Americans and also Black Americans with food. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that chapter and what you're discussing in that chapter.
So what I'm trying to do in that chapter, the chapter is called Everybody Eats. And that's a shortening of a song title, Cab Calloway's Everybody Eats When They Come to My House. And what I'm trying to do in that chapter is to suggest a kind of the template of a kind of cultural pattern in America that's it's been true of Blacks and Italians and Blacks and Italians in relation to each other, but I think also of other immigrant cultures and working class cultures, which is that it is food and music as consumer cultures that enable these groups to get a foothold in the American mainstream. And then in a way to sort of, and I'm sort of continuing with the metaphor of mothering that I developed in that first chapter with Dolly Sinatra. But my suggestion is that we can think of food and music together as a kind of mothering force in American life. I mean, it's more obvious with food and the ways that we think of maternity, body feeding, you know, the mother as food, literally as food, and the ways in which our cultural codes, you know, sort of elaborate that. But here, you know, here blacks and Italians, I've, you know, hopefully by that point in the book, made the case that, you know, they're both groups that suffer, you know, incredible economic dislocation, oppression, et cetera. I mean, obviously, there's nothing to compare with the experience of chattel slavery that Africans undergo. But of the European immigrants of the, you know, kind of late 19th, early 20th century, the Southern Italian immigrant is, you know, is, you know, a kind of paragon of suffering. And it's mostly Southern Italians that, you know, become Italian, the force that shapes Italian America. And so you've got these two groups that are at the bottom, and they become the two groups that really, you know, two of the groups that most prominently become, you know, responsible for the feeding in the largest sense, metaphorical sense, and the, you know, kind of comfort, if you will, and sense of abundance and pleasure in American culture writ large. So black music, I think, obviously plays that role, the way that black music is. I mean, where would American culture be without black music? We can't even contemplate it. Everybody turns to it, you know, as a source of, you know, kind of pleasure and expressivity, freedom, et cetera. Italian food at a certain point becomes, you know, we don't even call it ethnic food anymore. It's its own thing, Italian food. But things like pasta and pizza and such are so deeply ingrained in the American diet. And as a, you know, kind of symbol of abundance and warmth, you know, the Italian thing around the, you know, the kitchen table, you know, kind of serves a kind of, you know, important symbolic role in American culture. So I'm looking at the kind of cross currents of these things throughout that chapter, and also the ways in which, within these cultures, but in others as well, there are these kind of unrecognized intersections, or, you know, not usually noted intersections between food and music. The tradition of fruit peddlers and fish peddlers and food peddlers generally in urban America, and the, you know, the cries that the vendors and peddlers you know, sound out through the neighborhood, you know, this becomes part of the soundscape of American popular music, particularly in blues and early jazz. And the way that as those musics develop, I mean, they tend to develop in food spaces, restaurants, supper clubs, et cetera. And I, you know, kind of enumerate all the song titles, particularly in black music, that, you know, that bear out that, you know, kind of nexus between food and music. There's a long section of the chapter where I'm dealing with some specific Italian American writing about food. And in particular, a book by a writer named Louise DeSalvo called Crazy in the Kitchen, where she tries to kind of de-romanticize Italians and food by talking about a family experience that's really a very tragic one. And she relates the bad food that her mother fed her to a larger story that she wants to tell about Italy itself, kind of symbolically or literally starving its own in the late 19th century, and the, you know, these people who literally can't feed themselves in Italy become Italian Americans and develop this kind of glorious, you know, kind of food culture that we have here. And so that kind of narrative of agricultural lives as producers. In slavery, in the case of African Americans, in what Italians call la miseria, the misery in the South, how over a, you know, a couple of short generations, this gets transmuted into music and dance and cultural intimacies that become really, really, you know, I think a central part of American culture writ large.
And so from this chapter, can you move into, so we move from music and food into Spike Lee. You have a whole chapter on Spike Lee and sort of Spike Lee's use of Italian Americans and how he sort of how he shows Italian Americans in his films and his relationship with that. And so can you talk a little bit about that choice of Spike Lee and what he was doing in, like you mentioned earlier, in Do the Right Thing and Jungle Fever, and what you saw and how that also, I'm asking like five questions at once, but also how that related to, you talk a bit about how that related to what was going on at the time in New York, in those New York neighborhoods. So can you talk a bit about Spike Lee?
So I started our conversation talking about just how resonant and important those films were, Do the Right Thing and Jungle Fever for me, in the late 80s and early 90s, and I think for a lot of Italian Americans. And this is the time when there's a lot of really tragic violence in New York, in Brooklyn in particular, between Italians and blacks. There's the murder of a teenager who comes with a couple of friends into Bensonhurst to look at a used car. And gets set upon by a group of young Italian American men from the neighborhood, one of whom, you know, shoots him to death. The ensuing demonstrations in Bensonhurst, led by Al Sharpton. This is one of the things that really puts Al Sharpton on the map, and the counter demonstrations that Bensonhurst Italian Americans are waging in defense of the neighborhood and in a way that for many progressive Italian Americans becomes something of an embarrassment because of the racist language and gesture and the whole kind of racist part of Italian American culture that gets, you know, kind of spotlighted in that moment. So there's something in the backdrop that, and that's just one of several of these kind of high profile, you know, cases. I mean, right down to our own time, there've just been a number of really unfortunate cases of violence, of Italian Americans visiting violence on African Americans, including the police. And one coming from the community, the progressive community that I come from, can't help but notice that oftentimes those cases of police brutality and, murderous violence against African-American men that happened in New York, very often, in fact, almost without exception, the police officers in question have been Italian American. And there was the Rudy Giuliani mayoralty in which, a really aggressive policing ethos took root. So while throughout this book, there's a lot of really heartwarming ways in which blacks and Italians produce a culture together, there's also this other side. And Spike Lee seems to me to really, you know, kind of embody that and try to capture that in those films. They're highly imperfect films, I think, in a number of ways, but I try to make the case, really capture something very powerful about those tensions that I just talked about, but also something larger about the historical trajectory of Italian Americans and African Americans. I mean, there's a sense that African Americans, for all the problems that they're experiencing, all the urban blight and, you know, drug issues and such, I mean, there is the sense that there's a community that's engaged, that's fighting, that's struggling, that, you know, is still a community as such. Whereas with Italian Americans, there's been so much out migration from the city. There's been, stuff that has, kind of riven the Italian American community class wise. But also there's not a clear sense what the future of Italian America is. I mean, who are the new Sinatras? Who are the new heroes, et cetera? So there's that as well. But I got to talk to some of the actors who work with Spike Lee, and the complexities of, kind of cross-racial relationships that develop on and off the set. I also make the point that Spike Lee, I try to put Spike into the context of, recent film history and the extent to which he is, as a filmmaker, very, very deeply influenced by the New Hollywood and the Italian American figures in the New Hollywood, and in particular, Francis Ford Coppola and the Godfather films, the several Scorsese, Martin Scorsese, Robert De Niro collaborations, in particular, the boxing film, Raging Bull. And Spike talks about this stuff, quite openly in the diaries that he writes about the making of these films. And so there's an interesting complexity here that really sums up a lot of the Black Italian experience. And Spike himself grew up in a mostly Italian American neighborhood in Brooklyn, in Cobble Hill. And, so he understands that culture. And one of his actors is, I was going to say his Black actor is Giancarlo Esposito. He's actually a Black Italian, but he plays Black characters in Spike's films, but he himself grew up in Italy. He told me he thought in some ways Spike Lee had a better feeling for Italian-American culture than he did African-American culture because of that experience of growing up in that kind of neighborhood. And that's just interesting because Spike at this time is being, kind of elevated to the position he's a kind of not just a filmmaker, but a celebrity and kind of spokesperson for Black America, a symbol of Black America. And a lot of Italian Americans don't like these films because they think that they overplay Italian racism and aren't fair to the Italian characters. I think there's a lot of that in these films, but what strikes me about these films is the feeling for Black Italian, both conflict and collusion, both enmity and amity. It's all there in these films, and as messy as they are, I think they were singular in the way that they were able to, to accomplish that, and they kind of fill a gap in the representation of Italian Americans, urban Italian Americans, at a time when Scorsese and Coppola and other Italian filmmakers weren't necessarily staying with Italian American subjects, and they had begun to move into other subject areas. And so, for all these reasons, I think Spike Lee and those films figure importantly in the shaping of Italian American cultural discourse during this period.
Right. I found it really interesting too, when you mentioned it a bit, but that the different readings of the film, right. And that there were some more positive readings, some very negative readings, and even how the actors sort of had different readings and takes on the film. So I found that really an interesting way to sort of look at these and situate what Spike Lee was doing at that time. So you move from film to, and we've just had our March Madness and all the fun. And I think that I went to Temple. So you talk a bit about Penn and the Big East Temple and John Chaney, my man. But you moved to basketball and college basketball in particular and coaching. And so I'm wondering if you can talk about that, the role of Italian Americans in the sort of in coaching and in basketball and what you were doing in that chapter.
Right. So, you know, I mentioned some of the, you know, the coaches earlier. You know, they're still with us. Some of them, famously, John Calipari at Kentucky now, after starting at UMass in the 80s, going to the NBA for a while, and then Memphis before Kentucky. Rick Pitino. Rick Pitino, the only coach who's won the championship at two different schools. He won it at Kentucky, and then he won it at Louisville. Although that Louisville one has, I think, been vacated just now because of the all of the controversy that surrounds Pitino and his firing from Louisville and the scandal that's engulfed that program. But the older generation, Lou Carnesecca at St. John's, Raleigh Massimino at Villanova, and you know, somebody who, you know, in some ways is considered by, you know, kind of coaches, the great coach of this period. And that's Jim Valvano, and maybe one of the great coaches of all time. And another one of these kind of outsized, kind of charismatic, performative kind of figures. He wins the national championship in 1983 at North Carolina State with a last second, you know, put back shot. It's one of these miracle runs where his team was not expected to go anywhere, and they upset, you know, 5-6 teams in a row. And he becomes a kind of legendary figure because of that. And not so many years later, he dies tragically, prematurely of cancer. But has become kind of a patron saint of the sports world, and particularly of ESPN, which every year now runs this Jim Valvano, you know, kind of memorial, a week of fundraising for the, you know, kind of cancer research foundation that he started. And they replay this very famous speech that he gave at the very first of these, when he almost on his deathbed is announcing the beginning of this this cancer research fundraising effort. And it just occupies this kind of huge ritual kind of space within the culture of ESPN. And he, and like many of these cult coaches, their fortunes as coaches wax and wane, and sometimes they find themselves out of jobs, but very quickly they move into the broadcast booth or into other parts of the basketball infrastructure. I make the case that the college basketball for the last 30 years has been Dick Vitale, the ESPN broadcaster who comes out of New Jersey and coaches at Rutgers first and then Detroit and then in the NBA briefly, never has much championship level success, but he turns some programs around. But he really finds himself as a broadcaster in the late 70s, early 80s, when ESPN is just getting off the ground, and he's become kind of a notorious figure because of his loudmouthed, you know, kind of over enthusiastic sportscasting style. Some people hate him, some people love him, but nobody does not recognize his voice who's in any way, you know, a fan of college basketball. And I relate that to a broader trend line in sports media, where Italian American voice in sports talk radio and in broadcasting has been a, you know, kind of one of these things that's sort of been hidden in plain sight. And then there's Sonny Vaccaro, who is the guy who the marketing mind behind Nike's very successful move into college basketball with the swoosh sign and the you know, the Nike Jordans and a bunch of other sneaker designs that he that he's behind. And then he's a broker and a mediator who's the person, for instance, who puts Michael Jordan together with Spike Lee to make these what turn out to be really transformative, groundbreaking television commercials in the mid 80s based on Spike Lee's character, Mars Blackman from late 80s, I should say, Mars Blackman from the film She's Gotta Have It. And this is the most transformative person in college basketball, period, for the way that he gets Nike and ESPN and all of these big corporate forces involved in the game and, you know, essentially creates a much bigger monetization and corporatization of the sport for both good and bad. Good in the sense of, you know, the amazing revenues that are generated. Bad, you know, for all the amazing revenues that it generates and, you know, has really changed the scale and the scope of the game. But there's, you know, at the root of this, I think, is something about the way that these Italian-American coaches interact with black players, particularly inner city players, oftentimes players from broken families. They fulfill these kind of surrogate father roles, and the teams, you know, they kind of propagate this idea of the team as family. And that fits right into, you know, kind of broader, you know, kind of cultural tropes about Italian familial warmth. And I try to show how the situation's always more complicated than that, and it's as much image as reality. But there's also a lot of truth to the, you know, kind of the success that Italian American coaches have in recruiting and mentoring and getting involved with the families of their players. And, you know, even for all of the kind of conflicted terrain that goes with this is all happening, incidentally, in the same period that, you know, I talked about it a minute ago with the killing of Yusef Hawkins and the counter demonstrations and racism being flung from Italian Americans toward African American demonstrators. Even as all that's going down, there is still this within the culture of basketball, I think, this very important kind of alliance that develops. And it's an alliance that I situate against a kind of larger backdrop of coaching styles, born and bred coaches, and a kind of older WASP, culturally Protestant kind of approach to coaching that shifts over into a very Catholic, if you will, style of coaching. And the Catholic schools, parochial schools, become important feeders, literally, into the big time basketball programs. Not just the Big East, but your school, Temple, and others. And it also, I think, has to do with what I, you know, talked about earlier, this kind of shared black Italian passion for style and performance. Italian American coaches become known for dressing well, as do a lot of black coaches, at a time when the older, you know, kind of white coaches, notoriously Bobby Knight of Indiana, he's dressing down. He doesn't even wear a suit jacket and tie anymore. He wears a, you know, kind of gym, you know, kind of pullover sweater. And so the Italians and the blacks are kind of raising the level of self-presentation, if you will, in terms of sartorial choice. And I get into some things about language and music and, you know, kind of the rituals of pregame and, you know, kind of postgame performance and the way in which we can see acted out on basketball courts some of the same kinds of cross-racial intimacies that that earlier in the book I had ascribed to, you know, Sinatra in his relationship to the Count Basie band and other of his confreres in the jazz world.
Right. And so you sort of take all of this, right? You take these sort of topics that you've gone over in your final chapter, you sort of bring this all together and really look at some ways there is this intersectionality, right? You talk about The Sopranos, but other ways in which some artists sort of show this relationship between Italian culture and African culture. And so I don't know if there's anything you want to talk about with that sort of final chapter in the book and what you're sort of bringing all together.
Well, sure. So the chapter is called Tutti, the Italian word for everything. And it sort of has two meanings. One is everything, you know, that I was trying to sneak into the book that I hadn't gotten in yet. but tutti also, it comes up at the very end as a word that's used to describe the kind of aesthetic and the ethos of a man named Ficre Gabriesus, who the book ends in something of an elegy for this person I got to know as a friend. Ficre is an Eritrean. He was an Eritrean immigrant to this country in the late 70s with three of his brothers after they fought together in the civil war between Eritrea and Ethiopia, and they lost another brother in that war. And they became restaurateurs in New Haven and in New York. And later, Ficre married a prominent African-American poet and scholar, Elizabeth Alexander. They became, you know, together really important within the African-American cultural and intellectual community. And Ficre died of a heart failure, some sort of, you know, kind of valve issue, just a couple of weeks after his 50th birthday. This now is 5 or 6 years ago, and hence I call it an elegy. But I focus on Ficre because he brings that, he internationalizes my story, if you will. And the other thing I'm trying to do in this last chapter is to suggest that this Black Italian thing is, it's not just it's not just the story I've told in this book about something like U.S. popular culture, that there's a larger map here, there's a larger history. And part of it has to do with the Italian colonial presence in East Africa, Ethiopia and Eritrea. And Ficre grows up in an Italian culture, an Italian colonial culture. His teachers are Italian nuns. He learns the language fluently. He learns the history and culture. I mean, he's the most Italian person I ever met. And yet he's this African, you know. So in some ways he personifies the kind of border crossing that I'm trying to get at in this book. And so I talk about his cooking and he's also a painter, and his artwork and his family life as a kind of bringing together of, African culture and Mediterranean culture and, his wife, now widow, Elizabeth Alexander, grows up in a prominent, Washington DC, African-American family that has its own connection to Frank Sinatra, as it turns out. So I'm trying to pull these, you know, kind of threads together in that last chapter, including a little riff on The Sopranos, as you mentioned. And essentially what I say is that I thought The Sopranos really missed an opportunity to capitalize more on this Black Italian theme. I mean, it's my theme. It wasn't the theme of the show, but it was a latent theme in the series. And actually, I hear now that David Chase, the creator of The Sopranos, is doing a film that's going to focus on kind of the late 60s in Newark. It's going to be a kind of prequel to The Sopranos. So it's Tony Soprano as a teenager and his gangster in, kind of racially torn Newark, New Jersey. And that's exactly what, I'm not taking credit for this, but that's exactly the kind of thing that I was proposing in my few pages on The Sopranos, that it hints at that, interestingly, really interestingly, in the series, how the very fractious relationship between blacks and Italians in Newark, kind of apotheosizing in 1967 with the uprisings in Newark, is very, very much the kind of it is the backdrop of kind of ethno-racial politics that informs what we're seeing played out in The Sopranos in its contemporaneous account of the 1990s. And I think so much attention is paid to gender issues and Tony's relationship with his mother. And of course, with what I said about Italian mothers, I'm interested in that. But I think not enough attention has been paid to the race issues. And Chase himself, I thought, could have done more with it. So we'll see what he does with this this new movie. But then in that chapter, I also try to do a kind of survey of kind of social science thinking about race and ethnicity and how we think about race differently than ethnicity, but Italians become a really interesting test case because the way that they're talked about in social science discourse in the 50s and 60s, the diagnoses of problems in the Italian American community are really very similar to what we end up hearing about the African American community. And this goes back to the time when Italians, they were in the, up from the, during that immigration period, their racial status was really quite ambiguous in this country. A historian who's looked at this in the case of Chicago has titled his book "White on Arrival," Thomas Guglielmo, and so he's making the case that the Italians were white in the sense of falling on that side of the race line in Chicago during that period. Other historians have looked at other places and seen Italians who were, particularly in the South, Louisiana, Mississippi, how they were Jim Crowed in the same way that African Americans were. They were put into segregated schools with blacks. They were lynched, et cetera, et cetera. So there's this long and complicated history that I think is still being, we're still trying to understand.
So we've talked a while. So I don't know if you want to end, if there's anything you're working on that's a new project that you want to talk about, or if you're just sort of promoting your book or where you're going.
Funny you should ask. So, I've been flogging the book the last year and enjoying, presenting sections of it to some college classes and, some bookstore readings and that sort of thing. I've reached the point where I really need I need a new project to feel like I have a purpose in life and a stable identity, because I'm not exactly sure where I want to go now. I can tell you though that I'm guest editing a special issue of a journal called Italian American Review, and it's going to be about sound. And sonic, the conference that it came out of was called Italian Sonorities and Italian-American Sonorities and Acoustic Landscapes. And I wrote I gave the keynote lecture to that and elaborated on some of the things in the book about in Italian-American life, not just music, but kind of everyday sound. And the sort of micropolitics of sound, of loudness and silence and such in Italian-American family life. And I've got essays forthcoming in this volume that have to do with, I mentioned earlier, the tradition of food peddling, we're getting an essay that's not so much about peddling as about the fisherman's, what's called the Fisherman's Feast in Boston's North End. It grew out of the tradition of fishermen, you know, being loud and their language really being a kind of singular sound within the North End community. And the feast, the religious feast every year, even today, is called the Fisherman's Feast. And there's an Italian scholar who's doing a kind of sonic analysis of that feast. We have some pieces on early Italian-American sound recording, not just music, but, you know, humor and in the, you know, the earliest, you know, kind of recordings in the 20th century are of Italian-American performance. I talk a lot about the importance of Caruso in my piece. So we have some other people talking about not just opera, but the concept of the operatic, you know, as it kind of crosses boundaries, and other interesting material. I had been saying that I wanted to write a next book about sound, but I'm not sure I'm going to, you know, go that deeply into it. I might, you know, have to leave it with this special issue of the volume. And I would like to, I'd like to do a biography, but I can't find the person I want to do it of. But somebody who's in this, you know, kind of cultural space that I've been, I've been exploring. This book, unlike my first book about jazz, is not a deep, you know, kind of archival book. It's, you know, more about representation and, you know, my reading of different cultural representations and sifting of the secondary scholarship. There's also a lot of, you know, kind of personal, almost autoethnography in the book, but I kind of hunger to get back into the archives and have one of those kind of projects where I'm doing a lot of research and looking at documents and piecing things together that way. And if I could come up with a biographical subject for whom, you know, I could find letters and that sort of thing and photographs and such, that'd be the direction I would want to go in.
Well, it's been really fabulous talking to you about your book. Again, this is John Gennari, Flavor and Soul, Italian America and its African American Edge. John, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you so much. It was great fun, Rebecca.